This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
For the last gig in way too many numbers, you're amazing, amazing people to be part of the Festival of Ideas. Thank you so much for coming. We feel very cheered. We're wondering who the really famous people are that you're expecting to hear talk, because you've come in such numbers, but we are truly delighted to welcome you. The title of our session, The Place of Work in a Meaningful Life. We've got three very hard workers to talk to you. In fact, I count myself as well, all right, four, to tell you about how our perspective, and we'll have our usual half hour for your engagement on the issues. I want to begin by acknowledging the Kaurna people and pay my respects to their elders and acknowledge their ongoing association and custodianship of the land. My name is Barbara Pocock. I'm on the board of the Festival of Ideas Committee, and I've described it in other sessions as the best gig in town. I do have a day job, and that is as Director of the Centre for Work and Life at the University of South Australia. Our experts, as I said, are all very hard workers. Between them, they have written many books, passed many laws, contemplated the meaning of life many times, written many books that have had open discussion in the pages of our daily newspapers. And they couldn't have done all of this, I think, without finding meaning in their work, and I hope we're going to hear a little about that today. So I'm going to introduce our three speakers in the one block at the beginning. We're all going to speak then fairly briefly, 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll be open to discussion. I'm what's called a participating chair for this session, so I'm licensed to speak just a little myself, which is a great thing because I'd have a lot of trouble not, I have to admit. We'll have, of course, contributions from you. So let me begin with George Megalogenis. Many of us eat breakfast with George on most days of the week if we are reading The Australian as we are eating our muesli. George has been writing for The Australian for many, many years. He's a very experienced and senior journalist. He spent 11 years, he survived, perhaps is the right way to put it, 11 years in the press gallery in Canberra, and he now works out of Melbourne. He always takes a fresh and original and enlivening approach to complex data, makes us see it in different ways, and is always reflecting on the changing nature of Australia and especially its labour and immigration patterns. He's written two important books, Fault Lines and The Longest Decade. Welcome, George. It's very appropriate to have alongside a data expert, a philosopher. So Simon Blackburn is the Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of Trinity College. He's had many other gigs in many other parts of the world, including Australia, over his long working life. He writes books with wonderful titles like Think, books that are about the big themes in life, and like George's book, available over in the tent. He lists the big things of life in the opening pages of Think as issues like knowledge, reason, truth, mind, freedom, destiny, identity, God, goodness and justice. All issues which I'm sure he can bring to bear to our discussion about the meaning of work. And since he's come without notes, I'm sure he can reflect on all of those themes. So welcome, Simon. Thank you for coming. Now, some people might hesitate to be introduced by their former employee, but our next guest should hold no such fear. Natasha Stott Despoja was a senator in our federal parliament between 1995 and 2008. I think the years that you spend as a senator are a bit like dog years. You know, every year is worth at least eight in real time. Natasha represented South Australians through the Australian Democrats Party. She was leader of the Democrats and deputy leader during her time in Parliament, and she was a very fine leader at that, and that was when I had the pleasure of working for Natasha. Natasha has led on issues like paid maternity leave, higher education, biotechnology, privacy, women and the Republic. Welcome, Natasha. So let me then begin with a few comments of my own. What is the place of work in a meaningful life? And let's take a broad definition of work. The making, growing, doing and serving, but also the thinking, contemplation and creative activities that can be work. Remembering that work can be both paid and unpaid, done for money, done for love, done out of duty. A lot of us work for money, but most of us, and we've got very good statistical surveys on this, would go to work even if we didn't need the money, 60% of Australians. I was going to use no statistics, damn it. Why? Why do we love work so much? Work gives great meaning to many aspects and periods of our lives beyond money. I want to mention two aspects in particular. Firstly, the exercise of vocation, skill and accomplishment. Humans love to contribute. The paddocks of wheat, the graduated PhD student, the bills presented in parliaments, the patient attended to well, the wheel that we bolt on the production line at Holden, the well-driven truck. These are all feelings that can be associated with great feelings of accomplishment and efficacy by human beings. Workers take enormous pleasure out of their work. The centre where I work has a range of PhD students who interview workers and have interviewed many, many hundreds of workers over recent years. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking to a very senior executive in a large company or a cleaner on the production line in a factory. People will talk about the pleasure that doing their job well gives them. There's a second really important reason why we work, and that's to do with social connection, fun, laughter and relationships. I'm amazed about how much pleasure people say they take from their social connection through their work and the amount of pain they take when things don't work well at the relationship level. But not all work gives meaning, and work also, under some circumstances, sucks. It drains meaning from life, and I want to spend just my last few minutes talking about this. It sucks time, and increasingly in Australia, more and more time. It sucks energy, where it's intensive, where there are fewer people doing more, and for some of us, it crowds out love, contemplation and care. Work can feed the work-spend cycle, so it's a critical part of that consumptive cycle of you work more, you spend more, you have less time, therefore you work more, you spend more, and eventually you find yourself flipping from a work-spend cycle into an almost work-work cycle because the rest of your life is so starved for time and energy that there's almost a flip into a work-work cycle. And in that way, work can detract meaning. There are lethal circumstances under which that sucking power of work can be very strong. When you're doing tasks that don't matter to you, when you're doing too much work or work that's too greedy for your time and your attention, work that's too intensive or too rushed, work that's insecure and you can't tell whether you have the same thing to do tomorrow, work that is not properly respected or is underpaid, or work that's unsafe, work that drains your capacity to socially reproduce, to look after your children, to bear children, to even form a relationship towards having children, to be unable to care for your parents or for friends or others who need your support. Work that's undertaken with oppressive management shows up in all the research as being very, very important in draining that pleasure of work, or work that's undertaken amongst relationships that are truly awful. One of my favourite writers about work is a guy called Guy Standing, and he talks about the last three centuries and work in this way. He says the 18th century, just after the Industrial Revolution, was the century of the rights of labour, where unions were first established, where they fought for decent working terms, that you went to work and you had rights of labour. Most importantly, the right to go home with your body intact. 19th century, he says, was more the century of the right to labour. That is, everyone was looking for a job, the right to labour, out of the 1930s recession, depression in particular. But the right to labour was the critical piece for the 19th century. In the 20th century, he says, we have invented and imposed the duty to labour. So instead of being something which has good rights around it or something we we want access to. Now we have a social norm which is about a duty to labour. A duty to labour if you're an Aboriginal person receiving benefits. A duty to labour if you're a sole parent who's also receiving state support. A duty to labour around which your identity is increasingly constructed and around which our rising levels of social consumption, material consumption, rely. What we see also in Guy Standing's picture is a portrait of work where women are increasingly joining men in their fetish for labour in the 20th century and 21st century. Work's becoming greedy and draining, and it's fed by that rising plane of material prosperity. So in my view, work now asks too much. It's countering meaning at the same time as it gives it, and we need to tame work to make better meaning out of it. And on that note, I'll now hand over to George. Thank you.
Here you go, George. Yep. Can I do it from here, or do you want me to stand up?
I'm going to stand up, yep. That's all right.
Thank you, Barbara. That was a fine overview too, and I know this is my third session, so you haven't worked me too hard. Just one a day, which is probably the way it should have been, and congratulations on the turnout too. It's a pretty good effort to still be standing after 3 days of intense discussion and entertaining discussion. When we mention work in Australia, the first phrase that pops into our head is work choices, because our memory is still very, very strong on what happened at the last election. A society at as close as you can get to full employment sacked the government that made them wealthy. Now, the coalition probably to this day still think that the electorate was a bit ungrateful. The unemployment rate was below 4% at the time of the 2007 election. Household wealth had doubled over the period of the Howard government. Property prices had trebled over the period of the Howard government. And more people were in work than had ever been in work before. Now, the idea of work choices, just to remind you all, was, and this is the best possible gloss you can put on it, the strategy of work choices was to introduce it in good economic times when people wouldn't feel it, but it would be there in bad economic times to give employers flexibility to save your job by negotiating your wage and your conditions down. Now, if you were looking at a blank sheet of paper and you were drawing up the perfect work system, you probably wouldn't have gone for this system, because Australia had tried something wholly different for the previous 100 years. A reform this big, even at the top of an economic boom, is a pretty hard ask of an electorate, especially when you're a long-term government. But still, if you take a step back and consider what the theory was it wouldn't be felt in good economic times, i.e. there wasn't going to be that much political risk in good economic times. Now, obviously, that turned out to be the biggest miscalculation and the final miscalculation of John Howard's otherwise successful political career. From the moment the legislation was introduced, and then from the moment that passed Parliament, and then from the moment it hit the ground in the real economy, the coalition vote fell down. And of course, it didn't translate to a Labor vote until Kim Beazley was replaced by Kevin Rudd. And it took forever for the coalition to acknowledge the simplest of truths about work choices, that the Australian population doesn't want the government to pick a winner in the workplace. It doesn't want to choose either employer or employee. It rejected Labor when Labor was the party of trade unions, and it, in the most recent election, rejected the coalition when it was the party of the employer. Now, this idea of balance in the workplace, as opposed to the individual's balance between their work and their life and their family obligations, this idea that government shouldn't pick a winner in the workplace between the two parties, the employer or the employee, was a very, very strong view over the previous 100 years of federation. It's been reinforced in a way that probably be remembered now for the next two generations, at least, in politics. No one is going to forget in the next 20 to 40 years that a government lost an election at the top of an economic boom because it introduced a level of security into the workplace that the electorate thought was just un-Australian, if I could use that phrase in the term that it's meant. Now, the interesting thing about the way people feel about the labour market and have felt for the last 20 or so years, the memory of the last recession is still prevalent. I mean, we're going through an episode now that may or may not be a deep recession. And Barbara mentioned some survey material. There's some other survey material I got my hands on at the beginning of 2001. The ACTU had asked workers the following question. Would you prefer a pay rise or a pat on the back? I.e., would you prefer another pay rise or to have your work acknowledged and valued by your employer. Now, most people, the early part of this decade, preferred greater acknowledgement than they did an extra pay rise. Most people told the survey, the people who ran the survey, who subsequently ran some work choices research, which was crucial to the ACTU campaign, so the survey itself was pretty robust. Most of the people said that they had never felt more insecure in their work. Now, when I checked some of these survey findings, say with some contacts in the Treasury or the Reserve Bank, they'd say, well, that's interesting that they feel that way, but people have never been more secure in their jobs than they were in the early part of this decade. Now, that's something, Barbara, that we've always struggled in the research game to get the distinction between how the real economy operates, the turnover from full-time work to full-time work, or from full-time to part-time, or from part-time to unemployed. Jobs were more secure over the last 5 to 10 years than they'd ever been in terms of the statistics, certainly in a deregulated era. We don't have surveys that go back to the 50s, say. But people felt an insecurity well before work choices arrived. So this insecurity must be about something other than whether they're going to lose their job tomorrow. This insecurity has, I think, a lot to do with the difficulty people find in a deregulated economy to do all things that that a system like ours asks us to do. Cost of housing, and the way cost of housing has been racing up in the last 10 or 20 years, you need two incomes, not one, to service a typical mortgage. So that places a pressure in pretty much every household's decisions when they did go to work and the hours that they work that probably wasn't there for a previous generation. I'd like to run you through some very, very quick numbers, and I'll just give you an idea of how much the workplace has changed in the last 40 years. If we take 69, which is not a bad year to pick because that was the last time we were at full employment, the male unemployment rate had a 0 point something for 1 month in those statistics. Man walked on the moon, of course, everything seemed possible. Two-thirds of all jobs in Australia were held by men in full-time work. So that was 66% of all jobs belonged to men in full-time work. Women in full-time work held 23% of the jobs. So that's pretty much 90% of your jobs full-time. Women in part-time work, another 8% of all jobs. Men in part-time work, 3% of all jobs. When you look at those unemployment figures, and the unemployment figure was close to zero for full-time males, the unemployment rate at those days for women seeking part-time work was close to 10%. But there was no headline in those days because it never occurred to anybody that women might want to work part-time after having children. Because the assumption then, and the Bureau of Stats had these really interesting distinctions between mothers and other women in the labour force data, which might freak you out if you looked at it today. The assumption was that mum stayed at home until the last kid was ready for primary school and then she went back to part-time work. So there were a lot of women either in full-time work before they had kids and there was a fraction that were in part-time work after the kids had gone to primary school. Now, we know all that's changed, but something really big happened just a couple of months ago in the statistics. Men in full-time work are now outnumbered by women in full or part-time work, and that happened earlier this year. Now, if you wonder why people feel insecure in their work, predominantly, men in full-time work who accounted for two-thirds of all the jobs across the economy in 1969, this year account for only 45% of all the jobs in the economy. The insecurity you see in the research has a lot to do with the fact that blokes that used to trust the centre of the income ladder to be the place where most of them would cluster and most of them were on similar incomes, they've been sprayed all over the income distribution. Some are doing much better off, of course. Some of us who are doing pretty well and in the top 5% of earners think we work too hard and wouldn't mind. Not necessarily a cut in pay, but we'd certainly take fewer hours if they were on offer. We do have our obligations, which is why we might not be able to take the cut in pay. Now, let me go back to those statistics. Men in full-time work, two-thirds of all jobs in 2009, they've only got 45%. So we're going to chase this other 21% and work out where that went. Women in full-time work have only gone from 23 to 25% of all jobs. So it hasn't gone to women working full-time. As much as the feminisation of the workforce seems for women to be a pretty good story because it has something to do with the de-bloking of Australia, which can't be a bad thing if you look at what Australia used to look like in the 50s and 60s, these jobs haven't gone to full-time work. Now, women in part-time work is where one of the two big surges has been. From 8% of all jobs in 69 to 21% of all jobs in 2009. The other one, and this is a very important thing for men, from part-time work of 3%, now 9% of all jobs in Australia are men working part-time. They are not used to it. It's not what the male identity is. The male identity is still prime breadwinner. Now, a lot of these jobs are casualised. A lot of these men are lower skilled. And we know there's a problem for any society when it can't fully employ its men. The older demographic, we saw what happened in the 90s of all those blue collars who lost their jobs through the recessions of 82-3 and then 1991, formerly in manufacturing, formerly the centre of our society, some of them diverted themselves, politically speaking, to Hansenism. And that caused a problem. That caused a problem for our political discourse that may come back, of course, as unemployment is rising again. The younger group of men who don't work or who only are marginally attached to the labour force, well, sadly, what they do even at the top of the boom when everyone else is earning a lot of money is that they riot. We had three riots in the last 3 years of the boom in Australia. The one in Macquarie Fields, I think, is the one that people should pay most attention to. Most of those kids who were involved in that riot were second or third generation unemployed from jobless households where the mother, mostly single parent households, or even the grandparent hadn't had any experience in work. Now this is, whilst you can look at the stats, and again I think I made this point the other day, you could carve the economy and the society up any which way you want. Work is much more insecure in its distribution because most people aspire to a full-time job. People may be secure in the job that they're in, but I don't think they're happy in the job that they're in if they don't have a full-time job. And it's the flexibility down in hours that concerns people. They say it's job insecurity. They think they'll lose their job, but really the bigger issue is that they're not guaranteed a full-time work on any given day. Just give you one last thought. As recently as 20 years ago, and in South Australia, of course, you'd be well aware of this, manufacturing was still the number one employer in Australia, which is a male-dominated industry. Retail was number two, health was number three, construction number four. Retail and health are feminine industries in terms of the workers. Retail is now number one. So shopping has obviously been such a good thing for us in the last 15 years that it's now made it the number one employer in Australia. Health is now number two. You'd imagine that that would happen with an ageing society. Manufacturing has now dropped to number three and is about to drop to number four at the rate it's losing jobs in this downturn. Construction's just about to overtake it. Now, of course, what are you looking at there? You're looking at your McMansion and your shopping mall. Quite interesting if you've got a society arranged like that, pretty much to look after itself. It doesn't make things. There's a lot of brain power in the labour force because the fastest rising group amongst all occupation are professionals. But you've still got a great chunk of people doing things that they're probably not happy with. And that's the last thought I'd leave you with, and find out the meaning of life while we're at it from Simon. Cheers.
Great job.
Thanks.
Okay. Simon.
Well, that's a very hard act to follow. It's always dangerous for a philosopher to talk after people who know what they're talking about. And I found some of it extremely interesting. I think one of the interesting things I'd like to pick up is this question of the prioritisation or the overcoming of the workplace by things like retail and, for that matter, health. And what that tells us about what we think of as the sources of meaning. I'm in the Hyatt down the road, and which is just dropped my microphone. There we are. Thanks very much to the festival. I should start off by thanking the festival for putting me there. One of the things they do in hotels like that is they provide a little slew of glossy magazines for you to look at, and I looked at these and my heart just sank and sank further and further by the time I looked through all of them, because they're all things like Vogue and so on, and they're aspirational lifestyles. They're telling you, you know, if you buy this dress or this makeup or whatever it might be, usually dresses, makeup, that sort of thing, you're going to end up looking like, you know, Barbie or Angelina Jolie or something. And it's obviously false, and everybody knows it's false, but it's selling a fantasy. And, of course, a large part of the shopping malls and so forth that George was talking about are built to cater to that fantasy. The major retail spaces, I think, in most cities, and for all I could see in Adelaide, if they're not taken up by pubs and cafes, they're going to be taken up by dress shops catering to young ladies and cosmetic shops and things like that. And I think that's a sign of something very unhealthy, because I don't think those things are going to give meaning to life. You may want very much, and at certain phases of life, I think people will want very much to dress attractively so they can look sexy and feel in with the crowd and so on and attract mates and do all that good stuff. But usually it's not fulfilling. It doesn't give your life any meaning. So a society whose principal industry is catering for shopping seems to me one which is bound to be breeding a great deal of envy, a great deal of disaffection, a great deal of... it's building up a great deal of trouble as people realise that cosmetics or whatever it might be don't give them what they need in life. Because, as was also rightly said, what we need in life, I think, is some sense of achievement. I think at some level we all know that what you can get by way of admiration from other people, by way of pride in your own self, is not got by things like cosmetics or by getting big muscles in the gym if you're a bloke. It's got by doing things which other people can admire, which are worthwhile. And that is fortunately given to some of us in society. I'm not sure it's ever given to philosophers, but it's given to some, and so you get the health professionals, the dedicated nurses and so on. These are figures of genuine admiration, and rightly so. And I'm sure their lives are full of meaning because they know that they're doing something which reflects well in the eyes of others. And we're deeply social animals. One of the silliest things, I think, that the Christian list of seven deadly sins... Some of you know, I actually dipped my toe into this puddle and wrote a book about lust. The other deadly sin, which I wasn't offered actually, which I'd like to have written about, was pride. Because the Christian tradition says that pride is a deadly sin. I don't think it is. I think proper pride is a very, very important component of good life. If you can't feel at some level that you've done your bit, that you've done well, that you've done it as well as you can, and that you perhaps get a little bit of pleasure from the admiration of other people, if your life is absent all those things, then I think your life is absent a great deal of meaning. You can't feel good in your own eyes. And I think the desire to feel good in your own eyes, and that'll mean a reflection from the eyes of others, is, I think, a basic human desire, and you trample on it or ignore it at your peril. I think the young people who rioted, who were mentioned... there's nothing to be proud of if you're growing up unemployed, and a young unemployed male with virtually no money in a contemporary housing estate, whether it's in Australia or in England. You've got no meaning in your life. You've got nothing to give yourself any proper source of pride. And I think that generates what used to be called anomie, or alienation. And it's a cause of anger. And I think quite properly a cause of anger. If a society does nothing to provide an outlet, to provide a source of pride, a route to pride, then I think it's in great danger of creating a very, very disaffected underclass. I think that this is very important because a lot of discourse in political science and economics seems to me to be impoverished because it takes so-called preferences, desires, as a kind of, well, what economists call an exogenous factor, it's a given. You know, people have the preferences, and then the market is there to satisfy preferences in the most efficient way, and markets are very good at that. But the idea is the preference is itself a kind of, it's just something like the weather. It just happens to be there. Now, that is, of course, not true to the way an economy works. Go back to those magazines I started talking about. Their business is creating preferences. They're there to expand your desires. And the economy, may largely depend upon the expansion of those desires. That's why there's money in retail. That's why the shops get built and the malls get built. Now, of course, a lot of things you buy, you need to buy. That's fine. But a lot of things you don't. I don't. I think that preferences are not exogenous. Preferences are largely matters of choice. They're within our control. We can decide what we need or want out of life. I think one of the sad things, and this is, I think, one implication of the statistics that we were listening to, is that in family life, you're going to get on the treadmill, which is very often caused by preferences, the preferences of those nearest and dearest to you. It's very easy for a lone man. I'm not a lone man. I'm a grandfather. I've got children and grandchildren and a wife. And I know Australians are unshockable, but I thought I ought to add that. And of course, you know, it would be very, very easy, I think, for a lone person to make the choice to, as it were, soft pedal their desires. So I don't need this year's iPod. I don't need the biggest camera. I don't need all sorts of things. You don't need a car, actually, for most life, certainly most city life. But of course, when you've got a family, it's a very different thing. You do need a car. You need to cart the kids about. You need a the kids are going to be pestering you for the latest iPod. They're going to be pestering you for a bit of faster internet connections and a bigger telly and all the rest of it. And that puts people on the treadmill. If they're lucky enough to be in work, then they can perhaps survive on the treadmill. Now, I think it's part of the function of education to try to alter people's preferences, and at the very least to try to show people that they've got a choice about their preferences. They don't have to be the slave of fashion. They don't have to read Vogue and get envious of people who live in mansions in Bel Air. They don't have to have the latest iPod. Last year's is pretty good. And I think that's a very important thing. I think it's an important part of learning to take control of your life, that you learn to see your preferences as things that are themselves within your control. And I think it's a great problem in modern political discourse and economic discourse that elementary piece of philosophy isn't, I think, sufficiently noticed and sufficiently realized. So that's the first message of philosophy, and I think I've probably talked for long enough, so I won't go on and give you the other 531.
Good afternoon, everyone. I begin, of course, by acknowledging the traditional owners and thank the festival for the opportunity to discuss this issue before us today. I'm particularly grateful to have a philosopher to tackle what Barb was calling the capital M and capital L aspects of the meaning of life. Because I came up with more questions than answers when sort of pondering this topic this morning. What is work satisfaction? Does it depend on salary? Is it perhaps more dependent on that feeling of usefulness plus seeing, you know, a path ahead that signifies recognition? What about volunteer work? Do people get as much satisfaction from voluntary work as they do from paid work? Does this change when voluntary work is the only work available? If work makes life meaningful, what about retired people? Do retired people depend, or a happy retirement, does that depend on a sense that your working life was worthwhile? Are grey nomads searching for something to fill the void? Do they search restlessly for some kind of work substitute and then they die? What about, is looking after children work? And if not, why not? I'm not sure that it is. I think it's hard bloody yakka, but I don't know. I think that there are some characteristics of work outside the home that is quite different from that. And what happens when work is not necessarily valued in the home, or you have, as both George and Simon have referred to, those patterns of intergenerational unemployment? How do social networks formed at work fit in with family? The list obviously goes on. But against this backdrop of theoretical questions, if you like, I'm now experiencing the practical. a change in my work life that means that I'm questioning the place of work in my own life. And Barb suggested I should discuss this or personalise it, but it's true, my work has been my life, or certainly most of my adult life. My idea of a sense of meaning was about ensuring a contribution to society, you know, changing the world, making it a better, fairer, greener place. Wasn't always necessarily enjoyable or more stable or the happiest, but that's okay. I've always thought that life was not necessarily about happiness, but maybe a sense of meaning, you know, of making that contribution, the ability to look beyond your circumstance. My former job life arguably was compounded by the fact that I was defined, as many of us are, defined by our jobs. That also there was a sense of perception that the job never finishes, that you're constantly wearing the title. And I look back fondly to the first time I went to the supermarket after becoming a senator and have someone come up to me, on a Saturday it was, and said, "Oh, it's okay for some, isn't it?" shouldn't you be doing your job? So I imagined that, you know, there were perhaps more enjoyable, maybe more demanding, maybe less demanding jobs. Certainly some that may have been less scrutinised and at times less nasty. But all of that obviously outweighed the bits that I loved, and I was satisfied that I'd made a contribution. In the past year, I've gone from changing laws to changing nappies. My work is very different, and so I think is that sense of meaning. I heard from the teacher that my son Conrad announced at early learning the other day that his mum used to be Prime Minister, but now she has a real job. Simon, for your benefit, there's not a gaping hole in your understanding of Australian political history. My son confuses being a senator with being Prime Minister, and you probably shouldn't take anything he says too seriously. This is the same child that at the opening of the Rudd government in a joint parliamentary sitting yelled out, "I love Kevin Rudd." He's fickle. He said, "I love John Howard too," once. So it's just, I digress. But I'm not sure if my son Conrad sees my increased time with him and his baby sister as a real job, or even work, or whether he sees work as my sort of hurried preparations for a, you know, not-for-profit board meeting, or me thumping out a speech notes or a column on a computer. So it also led me to wonder about children and work and the influence of work with kids. How do children view work done by their parents? Are the patterns set in childhood? When a child says she wants to be a nurse or a firefighter when she grows up, you know, what does that mean? What is she thinking about? And maybe it is that children do understand dedication at an earlier age. Maybe they do understand that fulfilment is outside the home and relationships as well as inside. I know that when Conrad discovered Sarah's dad was a construction worker, he couldn't contain his sense of disappointment at the professions chosen by his parents. So, really, in the past year, I have had musings about the meaningful life and how work fits into that, especially those days when I'm doing the school run and I'm shouting at question time, to which I religiously listen to now, and I'm giving them standing orders advice. And that sense of missing that. Because retiring from the Senate after almost 13 years, or how many dog years that's translating to, was hard. I thought I could win the seat. I loved legislating, the nitty-gritty of lawmaking, you know, that ability to make a difference, and I'm sure an element of relevance as well. I knew laws could change lives for the better, yet this decision, I found an empowering one at two. It actually really helps me at my, you know, it suits my lifestyle at this particular point, particularly with young kids. So I was concerned that on my final day in Parliament last year, a television journalist gleefully probed and said, "Go on, admit it. Women can't have it all, can they?" Which I was actually proud of the way that I'd balanced my work and family over a number of years, and intrigued and very disappointed to see that decision, therefore, interpreted by some as an admission of failure or an inability to cope, or sending, worse, sending a message, particularly to other women, or parents that it couldn't be done. Because, of course, as you all know, women, parents generally in Parliament, are doing it. They're managing, they're doing it in different ways, and they make different choices. And choice, I guess my message today, is the key, in the same way it's Simon's message. But I guess I'm still debating how much the issue of choice is within our particular purview or ability to, you know, to ensure that we have that choice. So yes, that is an important part, choice, in terms of a meaningful life and achieving what we see as that elusive work-life balance. I know, Barb, in your books you've referred to it as the work-life collision, but I think that's a fundamental part of meaningful life. And all working families, to use the terminology, let's face it, all families work in one way, but all parents need help. They need support if they are to be effective workers and parents or caregivers, as the case may be. I spent a significant time in Parliament, or a significant part of my work life, in advocating structures and better supports that would assist that elusive work-life balance, because it made sense on so many levels, social, economic, and yes, because I saw it as having a positive impact on the participation of women in the workforce, in society, and therefore having an impact on equality in our society, or as George so wonderfully put it, the de-bloking of Australia. My perspective didn't change, but it was certainly sharpened when I became a parent. I became more conscious of the lack of structures and support and understanding in my own work environment, a reality of which I was reminded only a few weeks ago with the ridiculous overreaction to a senator having her baby in the Senate for a vote, but let alone the broader issues of the lack of policies that were being implemented to assist the wider community. Our laws and workplaces, as you've heard, the changing statistics, but our laws, our workplaces, don't reflect the change in our workplace and society, and particularly due to the significant changes in women's participation in the paid workforce. These days, there are half as many households with a male breadwinner, as you've heard, and a full-time female caregiver as there were 20, 30 years ago. As Gloria Steinem once said, we're becoming the men we wanted to marry. More people live alone, and at the same time, the proportion of single parents has risen sharply. There are more households, more than half, where both members of a couple work, and of course, even more households, too many, in fact, where no one in the family has work. So what impact does this have on living life, surviving life, let alone talking about what we might define as a meaningful life, be that, you know, the debate of ideas, education, lifelong learning, reading, whatever your definition may be? While I can't answer these questions definitively, I know one thing. We need a suite of reforms that will assist that work-life balance, whether it's affordable and accessible childcare, whether it's paid maternity leave or general parental leave, whether it's breastfeeding breaks or the right to return to work with some degree of flexibility after having a child. We need these reforms if we're going to ensure that Australian workers can do what they say they want to do, and that is spend more time with their families. When I had my son Conrad, despite a lack of formal paid maternity leave in Parliament, I practiced what I preach. I took 3 weeks off, sitting weeks, and I didn't work full-time for 11 weeks. When I returned to work, I was surprised by the reaction. One journalist said I'd had a three-month holiday. Ooh, yeah. One opinion editor argued that if I'd really cared about my child, I would have taken more time. Another said if I really loved my child, I would have quit work altogether. And another letter writer to The Australian, I think, said it's all right for some, like Natasha Stott Despoir. They can go back to work and take their babies with them. Can I just say for the record, I did arrange childcare. It's not like he was in the in tray or lingering in the Senate, you know. He did attend a couple of votes, but only when I was caught short, okay? But the reality is it's harder for some people than others, and specifically it's harder for some women than others. But I don't want to see us played off against each other in the workplace or the home. I want us to respect each other's choices while establishing ways to make it manageable for all of us when it comes to establishing work, entering the workplace, but also establishing a meaningful life. And besides, I don't think anyone has got it down to a fine art. After all, a single bout of sickness throws every career with kids' family into disarray. I understand the danger of this conversation is that work is perceived as a choice when, in fact, in our society, holding a job, any job, is a necessity for most. And Barb, your reflections were spot on in your introductory comments. So my contribution to today's debate is to argue for the creation of workplaces of all varieties that greater recognise the needs of workers and their families. Maybe work-life balance, ladies and gentlemen, is like happiness, striven for, but elusive, ephemeral, sometimes deceptive. Perhaps the best we can hope for is some fail-safe structures such as fallback childcare when all else fails, and ingenuity when flexibility is required. I know this would help me achieve a more meaningful life.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Laura. Well, aren't we generous? We've left an extra 7 minutes for questions and comments. So the usual Festival of Ideas Adelaide polite rules apply. No ranting. And can you be relatively short in your question or comment? And we promise to be not too long in our replies. We have to use the microphone because it's being broadcast later. Thank you.
I have a connection with all four of you because, Barbara, I read your texts, lots of them, when I was at uni doing my degree, despite the grey hair, that was 5 years ago. I took a degree when I'd done my time, George, at work, and working full-time, but equal pay for women came in, I think, the early 70s, and we know that
you don't have it yet.
It's not. No, it hasn't arrived. Simon, I'm giving my gold star to, on the strength of his talk on Hume and why he's not an atheist. If you didn't hear it, well, bad luck. It was fantastic. Natasha, at the airport, the Kosovars were being deported. Natasha was there, I was there. My banner said, shame to be Australian. Okay, I don't take Vogue, I don't take The Australian. In fact, I support our local independent weekly. It's all I can afford. So I'm sorry about that, George, but I do know you from your appearances on the Insider programme. And this is my time, I'm sorry, George, to have my revenge. I heard you speak the other night, and you devastated me. I thought to come in my undies today, but it's not a pretty sight, and it's too cold. You will know where my question is heading. You spoke about the women going there, doing the work, you know, the basis of what we've got today. But what we didn't have was we didn't have supers, and a lot of us, like me, no longer have a husband. Now, that's a good thing, but the bad thing is that it makes me very poor. I rely on the age pension. And I was devastated, and I want you to explain why you said that Kevin Rudd the other night should never have given the pensioners their... which we haven't got yet, of course.
I didn't say that.
You did say that. Sorry, George, you did.
On Friday?
Yes.
Now,
yeah. Is that the question?
Yes. That is the question. Not a bad question.
Thanks. Just move the mic on, if you wouldn't mind.
No. And I can clarify this for you. I said that he talked himself into the promise. Yep. I didn't pass judgment on whether he should or shouldn't have done it. Trust me, I don't pass judgment on these things. When I give you an explanation on something like that, it is what motivates the politicians. I try and stay out of the value judgments because I think in my job, if I started telling governments what they should and shouldn't do, I couldn't explain to you what they actually did. No, I understand the moral question. If you're asking me the moral question... If you're asking me the moral question, the full-age pensioner should have got what they got plus a bit more, and the part pensioner at some point in the future should have given something up because that's where all the money has gone in the last 10 years. A lot of the money has gone to people who have stuff. And that's been my position all along. Now, I trust, and I'm sorry if there was a... No, it's all right. I'm sorry. You can send it.
You can be relieved.
Yeah.
Who's next? Up the back?
Yes, sorry. I was looking at the question, the place of work in a meaningful life. And I, like a lot of you, used to work hard, work for the union in a lot of places, then did the absolute wrong thing. turned myself into a leper. I don't have a family. I don't have a partner. I don't have a job. I'm now injured. So the place of work in a meaningful life, I have now not got a meaningful life because of what people say. As soon as somebody says, hi, what do? I say nothing. And that's the other side, which I didn't even know about when I used to be fighting for all that part-time for women to come back and do all that, that I was pushing work so much I was forgetting the people that for no sake of themselves couldn't do it.
Does anyone want to comment on that?
I think just one thing about that. I'm not quite sure how relevant it is to your position, which I find very very difficult. I think it's I'm very sympathetic, but I did see a statistic, a social science statistic, which said if you had to choose for your children between becoming quadriplegic and winning the lottery, which would you choose? And everybody, of course, says you choose that your children should win the lottery. In fact, if you then look at them as a group, lottery winners and people who are paraplegic, who are therefore seriously disabled and can't work in most walks of life, it turns out that the paraplegics are happier than the people who've won the lottery.
That's right.
Because they have achievements to look forward to. They've got problems to master day in, day out. And that's the thing that gives their life meaning. So, in fact, by many measures, they're happier than the people who've got nothing to do because they just don't need to work and don't feel the motivation. So I think that, you know, it's possible to live a meaningful life even without paid employment, provided you've got something to achieve.
I think certainly my opening questions, I was trying to, you know, acknowledge that sense that it is amazing to what degree we define ourselves and our self-esteem and, you know, everything that flows from that by what we do. And, you know, whether that's paid employment or whether that's voluntary work and indeed unemployment, not working, not being able to work. I think all of those issues are legitimate issues and questions for debate. And while I, you know, personalised my story, obviously, you know, people say, oh, ho-hum, how bad it must be from going to being a senator, being at home with kids. That wasn't intended as a, you know, ho-hum. Mm. It was meant more in the sense that, you know, I have found that transition fascinating and difficult, incredibly challenging. And I remember, you know, waking up on the 1st of July last year and the first time I had to fill in a form and someone said, what do you do? Even, you know, so that's more a question not on, oh, gosh, you know, how does that work for me? But it is. Our society defines us and we define ourselves and each other so much by what we do. And then there are the debates that flow on from that as to whether or not we consider that work meaningful in its own right or if we're living meaningful lives. And theoretically, it has to be possible to have a meaningful life without work. And surely that's the society we're striving for. I love the fact that we're always talking about work and doing more and more work when aren't we supposed to be going, you know, surely the ideal is the other end of the spectrum, is it not?
I think the other piece in your comment is around the bodily integrity of work, and I think it's no coincidence that protection of the health and safety was the first concern of workers when they first collectivised, was to keep the body safe and to indeed live through the working day. So I think that is still a really important issue for workers. We still have many, many workers who are killed in Australia every day, especially many young people and self-employed people on farms and so on. So there's still a very significant issue there. But I think one of the changes in the nature of work that you've described, George, is that a lot of the injuries of work now are quite hidden. If you look at the injuries of very long hours of work, for example, they're often expressed in a car accident at the end of repetitive long shifts, or they're expressed in the health and mental health of people that never show up as a work injury but are indeed the long-term consequences of overwork.
Yes, my intermediate physics teacher taught us that when work is done, energy is expended. So I suppose that includes getting up from in front of the television set to go to the toilet. But more seriously, I look at work in two aspects. There's occupation, which is something which is fundamental to the human condition. It's what you do during the day, whether it's hunter-gathering or whatever. And then there's the job, which really dates from the Industrial Revolution. Now, that job works on the premise that you turn up at a given place at a given time and perform a given task and get paid an agreed sum of money. It's a very limited model. And as the previous person has pointed out, sometimes for health reasons, you don't actually fit into that model. It's a particular problem for the mentally ill. And surely we need to look, okay, yes, some occupations and jobs interact, they're the same thing. But we need to look more at the occupations, many of which are critical to the functioning of our society. We had, back in the 90s, a hospital here almost had to shut down because the volunteers threatened to go on strike. We need to look at encouraging those occupations and enabling people who don't fit into the job mould to fulfil a role as an occupation within society and still have a livable income.
Okay. Thank you.
Can
we take a little comment? And
I don't feel I've got anything to say.
Pardon?
I don't feel immediately anything useful to say about that.
But who's next with the microphone? So, where's the mic?
You're going to get a succession of life stories unless you're careful.
It's coming.
Hi. I just wanted to... I'm very lucky. I'm university educated and I get to work part-time and still earn a livable wage. But the reason why I do this is because I have a lot of other civic engagements. I sit on board of local organisation. I have my arts practice. I participate in a lot of community events and lobbying against things that concern me, and I read about what happens in our society, which enables me to choose those things that concern me and how I want to respond. And I hear a lot of talk about jobs and the family. I don't want a family. I don't want a partner. I don't want a kid. But how can we actually open up more dialogue about meaningful work and the community, creating space for meaningful work and civic engagement for those of us who don't want to spend our time changing nappies and want to just keep on changing the world?
Thank you.
Bye now.
First of all, can I just check, is there anyone here who actually wants to change nappies? That's but no, absolutely serious point, and please understand in my comments when I talk about work-life balance, I'm not... I think I've moved away, as many people are, from the work-family sort of dichotomy, if you like, because it's not about family. Not everyone has a family, or we define families differently, or we don't want families, or your dependents these days are just as likely to be caring for ageing and sick parents American and friends as it is for, you know, young children who may be dependents or sick children. So I think you're spot on, and I think that's why the work-life dichotomy is one that I think works a little better, and especially when you put it in the context of this session of meaningful life. It's about ensuring that people have the opportunity to do things with their lives, their brains, their bodies, whatever it may be, that is about, makes them a complex or multifaceted or what have you person. And then I guess there's on the other side, there's the debate about whether jobs are indeed occupation, something that you do to get money in order to finance or give you freedom to pursue other ideas, or indeed get back to what Barb and others have been saying, and that is deriving, in many cases, an element of pleasure or enjoyment or relationships or whatever from the work or job that you do. But I think part of it is the terminology we use. To get back to your question, we talk about work and life, or even when we start talking about life as encompassing work and every other component. But yeah, greater civic involvement, civic active citizenship, yeah, of course I'm going to support that.
Just a couple of points. One, last year Kevin Rudd had used the phrase working family, I think, for the 2 millionth time, and somebody asked him to define it. Could somebody without children be a member of a working family? And he said all Australians were a member of one big happy working family or words to that effect. Now, I don't want to bore you with too many statistics, but one of the things that's occurring in political debates is that couples with children pull the greatest attention from politics because the cost of the raising children, they tend to be at the point in their life cycle where the mortgage and the cost of raising children crash and they swing elections. Mm. Now, if you counted up all the couples in Australia with dependent children and then counted up all the couples in Australia without dependent children, since 2001, those without dependent children have outnumbered those with dependent children. So in terms of numbers on the ground, politics is actually zeroing in on the minority, not the majority trend. Mm. I just want to give it that to put the thing into context. I think that's the reason why it's wrong, that it's just about working families.
I
just wanted to invite George, looking ahead, do you think that's going to switch with more... Yeah.
It has to switch. It has to switch because the more diverse a society becomes, the more difficult it is to build an easy majority for consent for any issue, let alone consent in an election campaign, for a government to be elected or to be turfed out. So when you've got a greater diversity, and presumably with greater diversity you might at some point just get a fatigue in one or other of the political parties with men in suits as representatives, you could start to get a few of these issues thought and debated differently. Now, because this language is so exclusionist, if that's a word, because it means everybody in this room, well, if I look around this room, I know some of us have got kids, some of us got very young kids, a lot of us probably are past that point where changing the nappy is the thing that we dread most, or is the thing that has now become so routine that we've forgotten how we learnt how to do it, because we've done it so many times. But you don't unify anybody by dealing in an ideal. And I think this is, hopefully, Barbara, in the next few years that we'll see politics move away from a particular idealised voter or idealised household. Mm-hmm. They might find out more when they think more about who's actually out there.
Simon.
Yeah, well, just pursuing that, and this is not a very philosophical remark, the first remark is an entirely personal remark, which is today's my 65th birthday. But the relevant bit of this is there was a poll in Britain not so long ago which suggested that the biggest single worry, people were asked to order their worries, and this was asked of 65-year-olds, of new retirees mostly, although I can go on working, I'm very lucky. And the biggest worry most new retirees had was looking after their parents. And I think one thing that we haven't brought into this conversation really is that it's not just changing nappies. Well, crudely, it's not just changing nappies at the beginning of life, it's the equivalent at the end of life, which is also a very important social need, and I think one which can be very meaningful. I mean, my wife bore the brunt of looking after her elderly mother until she was 95 and died last year, and it was very meaningful. That was work, all right, hard work. And in some respects, unrewarding work, but in fact, very rewarding in a wider sense, because it was something that had to be done, and she took pride in doing it well. Mm. But I think that the changing demographic, the fact that the medical people can keep us going until we're some obscene old age, is very, very meaningful thing in politics.
Mm. I think we have one here.
I'm a little surprised that two important quotations or two important statements haven't been mentioned. One is Noel Coward, the master, work is more fun than fun. I think that's a wonderfully important and useful concept. And the other one that no one's mentioned this afternoon, of course, is Viktor Frankl and man's search for meaning. And the concept that the search for meaning is a very central part of our lives. So I just want to make a very naive suggestion. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, the people on the stage I just love it, youngsters. And I'm glad to meet them. But I have had longer to think about this than they have. And what strikes me is that meaning is feeling. You can't rationalize what we're talking about, because what is meaningful to one person is not meaningful to another. It's what feeling we associate with an activity that gives it meaning. And so when we talk about the meaning of life as a whole, I hope this isn't too naive, it seems to me that it's made up of a lot of little meanings. And that what has meaning is obvious to us because it associates with feeling. And clearly, there are a great many things in our lives with which we associate very strong feelings. And the most important probably is one's partner, and then in any sort of order, one's children, one's feeling for one's parents, one's feelings for one's friends, one's feelings for one's work, one's feeling for music. For some people it's football. Has to be a particular kind, I believe, called Australian rules. And so there are many more of these. I don't want to bore you with the list, but there are many more of these. There are a whole lot of activities with which we associate the feeling that gives meaning to that activity. And to my mind, the end of the story is that the total meaning of our lives is the sum of all these little meanings. We needn't worry about the meaning of our lives. It's so obvious. There are so many things that are important to us that give us meaning, and this, what we have is the sum total of those. So I have to turn this into a question.
Quickly, yeah.
What do my young friends on the stage think of that concept?
Who wants to start?
Simon, you want to go?
I guess that's one for me. I mean, I very substantially agree with you. I certainly agree that the phrase, the meaning of life, is very dangerous. It implies there's one thing, a summum bonum, a final good, and that's not true. I think it's very interesting that in Western European art, at about the beginning of the 17th century, you suddenly got, especially in Holland, artists finding meaning in the everyday. You've got an art like Vermeer or De Hooch, you get a celebration of the everyday. You're immersed in life, and it's how you feel about life that matters, as opposed to the more religious story, which was, well, the meaning lies beyond. You just put up with this veil of tears, and then somehow there'll be a reward somewhere else. The transcendental option, which I think still dominates too many people's imaginations. The bit that I slightly disagree with you about is, I'm not sure I quite like the word feeling. I think it's very important to human beings that they can, wonderful phrase of David Hume, somebody mentioned, that we can bear our own survey. And I think one can have a life in which lots of nice feelings happen. You know, as a young man, you manage to get off with lots of women and you go out drinking and you party and so on. And then, of course, the question is whether you can bear your own survey. And I think unless you can look at your life as having some achievement, some dignity, something that was more than just passively, for example, listening to music and enjoying it, then I think you won't bear your own survey very satisfactorily. So I think the slight element of hedonism, if I may use the word, in what you said, is one which I think needs a little bit of critical attention. But otherwise, I quite agree. Live in the everyday. Immerse yourself in your baby's smile, your partner's triumphs at work, your own enjoyment of this or that. And that's pretty much a recipe. And of course, the other great philosophical resource here is, forgetting yourself. I think narcissism, endlessly looking at ourselves and asking how happy we are, is one of the great caustic things. It's a complete destruction of happiness.
There's a question down here too. So up one here and then the mic down here.
The question and the answer.
Go.
Sorry? I think that applause was for the question and the answer.
I have a question for Simon again.
Oh.
I hope you like it.
I'm going to demand extra pay if this gets on.
Not bad news for you, son.
Okay. How can we make philosophy be seen as meaningful and valuable work? Because most often it isn't.
We need a couple of extra chairs here, I think.
You do know how to put somebody on a spot, don't you? most often it is. I think that's true. It's probably... I think it was Gladstone or somebody said that all political lives end in failure. And I think the same is substantially true of all philosophical lives. You try and do your bit, you try and work on a problem that's somehow in the air, that needs solving, and you try and say your words, and usually it doesn't go away, but you just hope you've pushed the stone a little bit further up the hill. The famous myth of Sisyphus, you know, who's condemned forever to push the stone up the hill and then it would roll back down as soon as he got it to the top. That's often seems a good metaphor for not only philosophy, I think, but literature, playwriting, art. You know, most people in those sorts of humanistic and creative industries feel that there's never a final point. There's never the last word. Human life doesn't permit of a last word. Shakespeare didn't say the last word about love and ambition and politics and so on, but he said some bloody good words. And, you know, if any of us could get, you know, that near to doing what he could do, we'd feel that was a life of achievement. Mm. That's what keeps me going.
Mm-hmm. There was someone... Oh.
I'm going to show my age now. When I first started, I worked for the public sector, and I work in workforce planning and policy. When I started in the government, one of my first jobs was the Department of Labour, and it was after Dunstan, but it was when we were experimenting with industrial democracy. Mm. And in the Department of Labour, we had a consultative committee, and we changed a number of local employment policies and things. And I guess one of the things, the quote about work being fun, work is more fun than fun. I think at that stage we actually were having, you know, quite a bit of fun. It was sort of new and things. But over the period of 30 years that I've worked in government, there's been a slow loss of democracy. Well, there's no democracy really. And I just wonder whether people see signs of that, you know, that resurfacing. And I guess Mary Parker Follett, in her writings in the early 20th century, actually talked about employee participation and talked about community and community centres and the democracy, real engagement at the community level, and that it should be brought back into the the workplace. So do people see signs of democratisation or better participation and engagement of people in the workplace? It's the 21st century in a knowledge economy. You've actually got to have high trust levels. You've got to actually be able to have conflict where you have good conversations about what really counts, and actually the broader conversations about your community too that you sit in. So that's my question.
Can I try something mildly optimistic? If the financial crisis is as profound as it feels, and it is going to hang in our collective memory for at least a generation, you take that first off. It's obviously smashed a particular idea of work and wealth accumulation. If you take the second idea that it's apparent to all of us now that our demographies are ageing and we are running out of labour, notwithstanding the the recessionary episode we're going through now. Those two things alone might trigger the sorts of... Now, an economist will say, isn't the market brilliant? It's eaten itself alive, and at the other end will come... out the other end will be something more viable. In a way, that is the point, that you can't see... What you recognise now, you can't see lasting for a number of years. So I think something is afoot. The other thing is, and you do go through the change in the shape of the workforce, women in work do bring a different set of needs in their negotiation with the employer. They obviously don't have that much sense that they have clout, but it will happen soon as the population ages and we do run out of fresh labour supply. Immigration program can't correct for what is happening to all Western societies in terms of the ageing of the population. So retaining the loyalty of your staff is going to become a lot more important in the next 10 and 20 years, I suspect, than it has been for an employer. The other thing is, the people who are running the businesses, running the organisations, have also grown up in this era. So their heads are probably a little more attuned to the needs of their peers, their own community. It sounds very optimistic, but you know, every time somebody recognises the problem, you're part of the way to solving it, I think.
I was going to have a bit each way, and please, no Democrat jokes. I was wary of following up George with something that sounded pessimistic, because there is part of me that, you know, as we're dwelling on the meaning of life or the meaning of work, that I get quite shocked at the intensification of work these days. The fact that, you know, among OECD countries, we're working harder and longer, and we don't seem to be, you know, nearly anyone, and we're just moving constantly in that direction. In the same way, the things that I consider fundamental to, you know, determining the meaning of life, like, you know, philosophy over there, the, you know, education is so pivotal to that. But how do we define education these days? It's increasingly a university degree is sort of a commodity. You pay for that to get your skills to go into the workforce and then, you know, climb up and make more money and what have you. I'd like to see a return to values that say, you know, education or philosophy is an investment in, you know, our future that has meaning in itself, and that... education, because it's the great equaliser, because it does result in, you know, changes to the workforce or what have you, or it means a better, healthier, more enlightened democracy. So there's part of me that says, yes, we have these values that are a bit skew-if and I don't see them changing, but like George, on the other hand, I see more educated people of all ages coming through the system, and surely that link between education and democracy in whatever setting, workplace, democracy, or democracy in terms of active citizenship and the rule of our country, hopefully those things will bring to bear, and what you talk about may come true. I'm not sure the impact of the financial crisis yet, because I suspect there's going to be sort of generations of having to fix up what's gone wrong as well.
Just a very, very quick word about that. I mean, from my experience in universities, because although I'm a philosopher, I also have to work as a university academic, I think things have got much, much worse in my lifetime. And I think a large part of that was the dominance of management studies and the view that everything can be quantified.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. I think the other thing that's against being optimistic is, for example, take the way people used to exercise voice in workplaces. It was unionisation. Mm. We've gone from 40% to 20% in 20 years. And I think a lot of young people who start out very optimistic and are very highly skilled and articulate find themselves in intensified workplaces where their voice isn't quite what they want. Now, maybe the demographic freight train will open that opportunity for them. There'll be people that they want. But I bet there is still a really strong occupational story there where the 20% of Australians who are low paid, for example, who are cleaners and so on, are likely to have a very different voice, even to the overworked academic.
I'd like to thank you all for coming along. What gives me a meaningful life is listening to wonderful speakers and being in the presence of people who like to do that as well. That's a great thing.
No comment.
I love my job. I've got a fantastic one. As I said to Barbara yesterday, I plant trees for a living. I've been searching for a meaningful life and work balance, and it's worked out fortunately for me. It's great. I love what I do. I do love confusing census takers and customs officers by writing oxygenator. Yes. I find it a hard choice between this one and the shaming mechanisms discussion. Mm-hmm. And part of our society, our shaming mechanisms are being out of work. Mm. If you're out of work, you're ashamed, especially by mainstream media and those wonderful talkback shows and current affairs shows. And I think what Natasha said was that work really it defines us rather than we defining it. Mm. And I like that my work, I've defined it. I've made that choice now. And we need to really break free of this dominant model of work and money and pull ourselves out of this paradox where we have to consume and we have to produce. There's not going to be jobs for people. And I've got this question about this utopian vision I have where if everyone received an allowance, we all got paid an allowance, and our basic needs were met, our healthcare, our welfare, our education was met, and therefore we were paid extra to go out and pursue work that helped building a creative, inclusive and accepting society, where would we be? So that's my question.
I think we'd be a lot better off.
Okay. Any last comments? I'm out for time, I think. Okay. I think I'm very aware that George has to catch a plane, and we want to send him back in a timely way to his family. I want to thank you all for being a really fabulous audience, not just at this one, but at the other sessions that we've all been part of. You've been really fabulous, and we look forward to seeing you again in 2 years. And please join me in thanking our wonderful panel.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.